Actor Orson Bean, a staple guest on game shows like To Tell the Truth, Match Game, and The Liars Club, died over the weekend after a car accident in the Venice section of Los Angeles, California. He was 91 years old. Bean was born in our region, in Burlington, Vermont, and in 2008, the Roundtable did a remote broadcast from the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts in Burlington, and we included an interview with Orson Bean, who had just turned 80 years old. We hear that conversation now in memoriam.
Get ready to match the stars. Orson Bean, Brett Summers, Charles Nelson Reilly, Pat Finley, Richard Dawson, and Joyce Bulafont as we play the star-studded Big Money Match Game 75.
Orson Bean was a fixture of game shows like Match Game, as well as What's My Line, and of course To Tell the Truth during the 1960s and 70s. More recently, he was a regular on CBS's hit drama Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. Bean, a second cousin to President Calvin Coolidge, was born right here in Burlington, Vermont. So we thought we would talk to one of the city's favorite sons. In fact, he would argue he is perhaps the city's only favorite son. Being a Bean fan, I was delighted to hear his smooth New England-soaked tones through the phone lines from his home in Venice, California. We talked about his varied career, politics, being blacklisted, and, of course, about his connection to this city of Burlington, Vermont.
Well, I certainly do. I didn't really have years there. I was born in Burlington because I wanted to be near my mother, and that's where she was. She was visiting her folks who lived at 112 Adams Street on the way up to the university. And then I really grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I visited my grandparents a lot. There was always a college kid staying in the spare room. They would give a spare room all the time to some college kid who needed a place to stay. And I remember Burlington as a sleepy little college town with barber shops and five and tens. But when I was asked to come back to be the Grand Marshal in the parade in 76 for the 200th anniversary of the country, and since I was the only one they could think of to do it, I was shocked to see the changes that had happened. It was a very festive time, of course, even in Burlington. And there was a big party that night when I arrived with my family, and the guy came up to me and said, "I'm the local Gestalt therapist." I said, "Oh, I'm glad to hear it." He said, "Have you seen our little underground newspaper?" And handed it to me. And the headline said, "Communal Lesbians Assail Lesbian Monogamy." I said, "Wow, Burlington, this is not the Burlington of my infancy."
What do you think of the changes of Vermont? Of Vermont being a very liberal and, excuse this term, but a crunchy state?
It's an odd thing. I suppose a lot of liberals from Boston and New York moved up there and took advantage of a tendency which always existed to say, "I don't care what you do as long as you don't frighten the animals." I remember when I was up there in the 50s, there was a softcore porn movie playing at the local theater called Nature Girl and the Slave Trader. And I said to the guy that ran the drugstore next door, I said, "Wow, they can't show, I mean, it was bare breasts, that's all it was. I mean, nowadays you can show it on television. But in those days, you couldn't show such a thing in New York City." And I said, "How come you can in Vermont?" And he said, "Well, we don't like people telling us what to do, so we understand we can't have the right to tell other people what to do. And if the college students want to see this trash, well, we have to let them." So there's always been this laissez-faire thing going back to Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, I suppose, that they just don't want restrictions, even if it's on stuff that they don't agree with. And I think that since that basic thing existed, that, you know, a lot of left-wing intellectuals came up and said, "Wow, this is our home," and moved in and kind of changed the feeling. But underneath it had always been there.
When we watched you on television, on game shows, of course, you came off as the quintessential New Englander with the accent and the crew cut. Do you think that's fair to say, that you were the quintessential New Englander?
Well, I affected it. I had an opening line. good evening when I did my nightclub act. My name is Orson Bean, I would say. Harvard 48. And I'd take a pause and I'd say, Yale nothing. And people would come up to me in the clubs and say, oh, my brother, my older brother went to Harvard with you. I never even went to Harvard, but I would just say, oh, thanks, remember me to him, you know. My father was a yard cop at Harvard, so I grew up in the shadow of the ivy of Harvard, but I never went there. I felt that the minute I could get out of high school, I was free. Great God, I'm mighty free at last. I hated school from kindergarten on up and felt that the only way I could survive was to drive the teachers crazier than I felt they were trying to drive me. So they were glad to get rid of me, and I was glad to get sprung.
But certainly strong roots to New England. Second cousin to Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, my grandfather's mother and Cal's mother were sisters, the Moore girls. And when Cal's mother died, his aunt, my great-grandmother, took him in, much to the chagrin of my grandfather, who had to share his room with him and his bicycle and his toys, and never liked him as a result. Didn't like him when he became governor of Massachusetts, didn't like him when he became president, all because he'd had to share his stuff with him. His brother, my grandfather's brother, Park Pollard, was the head of the Democratic Party in Vermont, back in the days when there was, like, no Democrats. I mean, the whole country would vote for Roosevelt, except for Vermont and New Hampshire. So what patronage there was came through Uncle Park. He got to parcel out the post office jobs and the federal money for roads, what little there was back then, and because he was the black sheep of the family, because we were all Republicans. But Uncle Park was quite a powerful man, since nobody else wanted the job or had the job, but a lot of patronage came through it.
Now, you were a man who was blacklisted in Hollywood for having very liberal views. And how would you make out in Vermont in its current political state, do you think?
Well, I've become much more conservative. I don't regret anything. I was never a communist, but I was horny for a communist girl who dragged me to a lot of meetings. And then I ran for office in the television union and got blacklisted as a result. And, you know, I didn't really mind. I mean, I got lucky and got a Broadway show the year that I remained blacklisted off of television. I was a regular in the Ed Sullivan Show, and Ed himself called me up and said, I'll help you when I can. And he did. A year later, he booked me back one time on the Sullivan Show. And then, little by little, the blacklist waned, partly because of our liberal do-gooder efforts to end it. So now I suppose maybe I'll be blacklisted as a right-winger. I don't know, but my whole family is little communists. You know, I think you should be when you're 20, 30, 40. And when you get to be 80 like I am, you're supposed to be a grumpy old man.
You talk about that time on Broadway. You had wonderful success and Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter and Subways Are for Sleeping and received a Tony Award nomination as Best Featured Actor in Never Too Late. Did you enjoy that time on Broadway? Did you enjoy the stage work?
I loved it more than anything. Acting in the theater is what actors live for, and I think 90% of all actors will tell you that. Acting in the movies is a chore. You have the fun of working about, you know, maybe 5 minutes out of every hour, and the rest of the time you're in your trailer waiting to be called. Laurence Olivier famously once said of the movies, the acting is free, what we get paid for is the waiting around. So working in the theater is tremendous fun. And now my wife and I are very involved with a theater company out here, and I just finished a year's run of a couple of different plays. And I must say, it's just as exciting to do Chekhov in a church basement as it is to open on Broadway. I've done both, and I find them both exciting. It's the actual work which is fun, and the interaction with the audience.
So many of us know you from your appearances on game shows during the 60s and 70s and 80s. I've Got a Secret, To Tell the Truth, of course, Match Game. Did you enjoy that work?
I loved being in game shows. I mean, to get paid for doing the same thing I was doing when I was 11 is quite a coup. And the one that I was on the longest, To Tell the Truth,
right.
I was on that 7 years, sitting between Kitty Carlisle and another New Englander, Peggy Cash. In fact, recently I was mentioned in the paper over something, and it said, last surviving member of the panel of To Tell the Truth. I said, oh, boy. But, yes, those shows were really fun and educational, too. Certainly And to tell the truth, I learned a lot because there was liars up there convincing me that they had climbed the Matterhorn or ran the Dude Ranch or, you know, had done one extraordinary feat after another. And I just learned a lot of stuff out of it, which I now put to use doing crossword puzzles.
Because you were basically interviewing. It was a wonderful setup. I guess Bud Collier was the original host, and then you also worked with Gary Moore when he hosted as well.
That's right. And we would interview them. And I learned a lesson which the other panelists didn't seem to have learned, which is that there were always one real guy who had, in fact, climbed the Matterhorn, and two liars who were pretending to be him. So the liars had worked really hard to learn a lot of stuff and wanted you to know it. The real guy, who didn't want you to guess him because he wanted the $125 he was going to win, would tell you as little as possible. So when the other panelists would say, I voted for number three because he knew that the Matterhorn is above the frost level is thus and such, that's exactly why I didn't vote for the guy. And because I didn't give a damn whether I was right or not anyway.
Number one, you can't get accredited in flying rings or something, right? This is strictly extracurricular, right?
That's right, yes.
Does it take as much time as, say, football would and as much training?
Well, just about every afternoon after classes.
Yeah. Number three, how many times a year do you put your circus on?
We have one big show in March.
And that's it? You don't tour it or anything?
Yes, we do. We tour to smaller cities.
Smaller cities? And is the public charged admission when you tour?
Not usually.
No? Well, who goes? Kids from orphanages and things like that, or just the general public?
General public.
Well, number two, if the general public goes, do you agree with three that no admission is charged?
No, it's 75 cents for children and $1.50 for adults.
Number three, you want to change your statement? Or is two a liar? And you're the real one, right?
You had such success in those programs and, of course, the stage work as well. You wrote a book many years ago in which you, by your own account, basically dropped out of sight during the late 70s and 80s, moved to Australia, experimented with everything from group sex to dropping acid.
I did, and I don't regret it. It was a lot of fun, and I'm glad it's in the past. And I bought an old VW van and threw my family in it and traveled around and made a living by going on the Tonight Show once a month and saying what odd, strange, hippie experiences I'd had. And we lived low off the hog, deliberately. We bought A&P brand Rice Krispies to save the money and didn't watch television because we wouldn't pay for the cable. And I went through a period of years living cheap and enjoying it. And then I realized I didn't have to go on doing that.
You were one of those people, and very few can pull this off and can have this title and really have it be apt, but when you were called a raconteur, do you like that?
I sure do. A raconteur is a teller of tales, and it goes all the way back to the African griots and all the way back really to the days when the Odyssey and the Iliad were written before there was written language. So, being able to tell a story, like even telling a joke is an art form. A joke should be told as short as possible and be in the present tense. And there's a form to it. And so being a raconteur is fun. Jack Parr used to populate his talk show with raconteurs, people who were conversationalists. Now the talk shows have got people who are on plugging their new movie. So it's different. You know, I still like watching David Letterman, but in those days it was raconteurs who raconted their stories, and it was quite interesting. When Johnny Carson quit, NBC sent out the list of the top 10 most frequent guests, and I always like to tell people that I was number 6, just under, you'll pardon the expression, Charles Nelson Reilly.
In 1993, you got the role of the frontier storekeeper, Lauren Bray, in Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And I assume that really introduced you to a whole new audience.
I guess so. It was wildly popular in what is now called the red states and pretty much ignored on the coasts. So to this day, people come up and say, I'm from Arkansas and I still watch reruns of Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. But it was a good place to hide from the industry itself, which kind of poo-pooed it. But we had a lot of fun doing it. It was shot up in the mountains and beautiful on the old Paramount Ranch where the TV show MASH used to be shot. It substituted Korea. And we had great fun doing it. We were outdoors all day, and it was full of horses and horse poop and flies, and we weren't stuck in a studio. So, you know, it was just an enjoyable shoot.
Says here, children of all ages available for immediate adoption. Mostly American-born orphans.
Mostly.
Let me read, will you? Lacking in guidance and education.
Sounds like a sorry bunch.
You got it.
But most of them ain't even orphans. City's back east are overflowing, so they ship them out to us.
Well, what are we supposed to do with them?
Put them back on the train.
So we ought to take a look at them.
You just turned 80. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I suppose there's still a lot you want to accomplish, isn't there?
Well, I've got a new book coming out next month called Mail for Mikey, which is a series of emails sent by an older man to a 20-year-old drunk in a 12-step program in which he teaches him about life. So I'll be making the rounds of the TV and radio shows to promote that and doing book signings and bookstores and that sort of thing. So, you know, and it's really about how I developed a relationship with God. But it's never going to be carried in any Christian bookstores because it has the F word in it, and it has a big blurb on the cover from my late friend George Carlin. So it's a mixture of things, but I'm proud of it and happy about it. It's funny, and I hope instructive.
And, of course, you continue your work with the Pacific Resident Theater Ensemble of Venice.
Yes, we just finished doing My Wife and I. My wife is Allie Mills, who played the mum on The Wonder Years.
Oh, yeah.
And who is currently a bad girl on a CBS television soap. She's having the time of her life on a show called The Bold and the Beautiful, playing the bad girl. You know, and everyone loves the bad girls on the soaps. So the two of us just finished a long run in a forgotten J.M. Barrie play, which he wrote a year after Peter Pan. It was a huge success and a wonderful play. And you know, as I said before, working in a small 99-seat theater is just as exciting to me as opening on Broadway was.
Well, Orson Bean, it is such a delight. I've been a fan of yours for a very long time, and to have you on the program, especially as we broadcast from Burlington, is quite a treat. I thank you so much for spending the time. I thank you for all the years of great work and a lot of laughter, and I wish all the luck in the future as well.
Bless your heart, my lad. Good luck to you, too.
Our 2008 interview with Orson Bean. He died over the weekend after a car accident in Los Angeles at the age of 91. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.